So I'm very happy to be here tonight. I don't know, as far as I know, I don't know any of you. Is that much I know? Except for Janice, of course, who's been hosting me for the last couple of days. And I gather that many of you have been practicing for some years, have had already some understanding of Dharma, some have gone through the blessings of dukkha and been transformed and through your own practice. So let's see what will happen tonight. We don't actually, of course, I do reflect on some of the themes that will be interesting for you to hear, or some of the particular point of practice that will be helpful for you. We don't tend to have notes, so it is a little bit of, it's like plunging into to the abyss, and you don't quite know what's going to come and happen. So we have a tradition of taking refuge in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha before we start giving the talks. I'll do that. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangam namassami. That's to make sure that we not get off on kind of mischiefs. You know. Keep us on the right track. So, I'm sure some of you have heard everything about the Dhamma. You've been saturated with teachings from so many different angles and traditions, and hearing the Dhamma from different teachers, from their experiences and so on. But yet, as we know, the Buddhist teaching or the Buddhist path is really a training of the heart, a training of the mind. That's just one word we can use. I know it kind of makes people tick, training, oh God, another training. But it is really a training, a kind of educating one's heart, teaching one's heart how to recognize the Dhamma when it's there, how to recognize when it isn't present, how to follow a path that is leading us to a greater sense of happiness, a greater sense of inner ease and well-being, a sense of trust and confidence, a greater kind of, a deepening of our experience as a human being, and the gracefulness of being human, deepening that sense of confidence and trust. Now, how do we do this? Many of us practice the path for many years and still find themselves quite frustrated and quite sort of feeling they're not going anywhere, maybe, or they're not getting the results they should get, or they're not, happy. And wondering why this path, which is supposed to lead you to happiness and peace, is not doing the job. We have a lot of expectation about how things should be. Very often, we don't realize how much we carry in our mind, in terms of what we expect a practice to be, what we expect journeying on the path is going to be, what kind of landscape we're going to meet, what kind of challenges, we're going to face, what kind of results we should get. So how much are we really being present with our own mind. How much are we being here and now? Because that's really what this teaching is pointing constantly, isn't it? The practice of mindfulness, the development of satipanya, wisdom, mindfulness and wisdom, is about being in the here and now. Now, of course, when a teacher who's been quite liberated on her or his path talks about the here and now, there is something very refreshing and something kind of inspiring about being present. The simplicity of the present moment is something we all aspire to, aren't we? Just simplifying our life and being just happy just where we are, content just where we are. Isn't it a wonderful possibility? All right. Mm-hmm. Sounds good, doesn't it? So, fortunately, it sounds good. That's a beginning. Somebody told you it was just dukkha, dukkha, dukkha all the way. We might not be quite sort of, you know, attracted to come here and practice the Dhamma. But you could say the whole training of our heart is to how to be present and look at the present moment. Be present. Be in the present moment. When you say the present moment, it's a nice word, isn't it? We don't disclose yet what's going to happen when you are present, do we? Do we disclose all the intricacy, complexities, madness of our mind? No. This is something you discover along the path, don't you? Do we disclose, you know, the conflicting energies, the confusion that we go through, the conflicting desires that we inhabit? You know, one part of ourselves would love to be at peace, another part just love excitement. One part of ourselves, we are really happy to die to an old part of our egos, the bit that we've seen for years and years, we're so bored with it that we just want to check it out. And there's another part that we just love, identify with, and will die rather than to let it go. We'll rather hang on to it with all the mass of suffering that it brings, rather than to drop it. And being present, being in the present moment, is really a dangerous affair. Because what's happened when you're present is you're dropping things. So how much do you want to do that? You're actually letting go, you know. And so you could say part of us loved the idea of letting go. And then we meet all the other parts of ourselves which are not particularly interested in transformation, not particularly interested in moving on, in other words, you know, in allowing change to happen. This is why the Buddha straight away foresaw the problems that we could be confronted with, which were, you know, what am I going to teach to these guys, you know? Well, the first one thing is that, you know, what you're going to see is suffering. At least we are clear. What you're going to see is changing. And what you're going to observe in the present moment is not what you are, is not your true nature. It's neither your false nature. It's just changing. So if it is changing, it's not very reliable, is it? It's moving on all the time. So how can you depend on that, on something that is constantly moving on? And so we are taught, how to look carefully, you know, in the right direction for the thing that are going to help us to liberate ourselves. From what? What are we going to be liberated from? You know? What do we want to get liberated from? Are there anything we want to be free from? Maybe you might think, no, I don't want anything. I'm quite happy the way I am. I'm fine. I'm okay. In fact, my teacher told me I'm okay. I don't need anything. I don't need to change. So that's fine. The Buddha's teaching doesn't ask you to, you know, to think differently or to feel differently or to perceive yourself differently. But he is really pointing to, you know, our human experience. And within this human experience, we encounter what he defined as delusion. And delusion means not knowing, not understanding, not seeing clearly, not perceiving in the right way. You know, what is it that we don't perceive in the right way? You know, do we experience ourselves as we are? Do we experience ourselves as we wish to be, as we should be? Or do we know how to allow ourselves to be as we are? We are part of a culture which is extremely demanding, which is compulsive, and which has educated us in such a way that we've become, you know, for decades now, you know, the greatest experts in critical thought. You know, we can see everything that's wrong. We just look at something, we've been educated from childhood, from babyhood, as soon as you're in the cup there, and you can see, I don't like that. Oh, he's so clever, you know, he just knows exactly what she wants or what he wants. You know, I like this, I don't like that. You ask lots of questions, you have lots of doubts in your mind. It's, you know, what an intelligent boy, what an intelligent girl. The more you question, you know. So we're not going to beat ourselves up for that. This is just part of our cultural conditioning, isn't it? We don't want to be like, you know, thinking, oh, I should be like an Asian, Thai, full of faith, full of completely wholehearted, you know, acceptance of my teacher's teaching, you know. We have a saying in Thailand, when you have an abbot with Asian people, the Asian people go and see the abbot, and the abbot says, it's all anicca. And the whole group just kind of rise up with glowing face and eyes and saying, sadhu, 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 and they go away absolutely overjoyed, you know. Then the abbot feels quite happy. And then you've got the abbots and a group of Westerners coming to see them, you know. Lots of Western monks and nuns now in Asia. And so the abbot says, it's all anicca, dukkha. Yes, but why and how? And what? Well, I don't agree with that. I've seen the other thing. No. Maybe. Are you sure? How do you know? Are you enlightened? So we are called the no-faith type, you know. But it's not exactly that. It's just our cultural conditioning is like that, you know, that we have faith in critical thought, don't we? So what's wrong with that? Doesn't mean we're more stupid. We've just been conditioned in a different way. Doesn't lead us to any more peace or any less or any, you know, Thai people or Asian people have as much dukkha, neurosis and, you know, are as crazy as any of us. They just have a tendency to believe in things more readily. So if the teacher is a good teacher, that's fine. But if he's an idiot, that's also, that can be dangerous, to believe in somebody who has no wisdom or no much knowledge or realization. So, you know, on the path of practice, you're told again and again and again, be present, you know, be here now. Then we get bored with that, don't we? Be here now, after a while, you know, so what kind of thing? Be here now, I've been here now for 20 years, you know, nothing has changed. And sometimes we mistake the path of practice with the path of, you know, of reconditioning ourselves just to be a happier being. We don't realize that the path of practice is a path that takes us down avenues which are not comfortable. You know, the path of transformation is not a comfortable path. It's going to be disturbing. Are we ready for that? Or do we want just to kind of, you know, have a happier relationships, get on with my mother better, make sure my dogs are not a problem? Do we want to just have a better job or a better lifestyle, earn a bit more money, or not be so upset when you don't earn so much money, or, you know, just make the whole conditioned world a bit more comfortable? There's nothing wrong with that. We still, you know, we are all creatures of happiness. We all want to be happy, from the lowest realm to the highest realm. Everyone wants to be happy. You know, and the Buddha has never said that happiness is a wrong path, aiming for happiness. He just points out to a happiness which is not recreating neurosis. You know, he's actually pointing to a happiness that is leading to freedom, independence, confidence, you know, which means whatever happened in your life, happiness is not taken away from you. Isn't it wonderful? You can be old, sick, miserable, in pain and everything, you still don't have to be miserable. That's what he's saying. Things can change, they can be suffering, they can be taken away from you, and you understand it's okay. You're happy. Your happiness is not taken away. Your heart is not dependent on anything external, on any worldly things, on what people think about you or don't think about you. Isn't it a great, wonderful thing? That some people can see you're a complete idiot, but you feel completely empowered in yourself, and you know yourself well enough to know that it's okay for other people to think what they want to think. It's okay for your mother to feel that you are a complete idiot, or your father, or your partner. They have the right to think the way they want. But you have also the right to think the way you want. You don't need to agree, or feel completely victimized, undermined, trampled, crushed by what the world is doing with you. So this is what the Buddha's teaching is aiming to, that sense of inner independence. So to go back to the experience of the present moment, are we ready to see what the present moment is like? Mm-hmm. Most people, you know, we can feel very bored by just being present. You read Thich Nhat Hanh, this beautiful poetical kind of description of walking, being present and so on. But when you actually do it on a retreat and you walk in meditation, after 10 minutes your mind is thinking about shopping list, isn't it? And then the next thing you know, you beat yourself up because you've been doing your shopping for 10 minutes on your walking meditation path, and then you start planning the next holiday, you know, and then you have another beaten up session. Nothing like Thich Nhat Hanh will describe as this beautiful wandering, you know, breathing in and breathing out, you know. I'm one with the universe, breathing in, breathing out, the flowers is talking to me. Breathing. No, and it's not to criticize Thich Nhat Hanh. I mean, that's his experience, obviously, but for most of us, it's not like that, is it? It's that when he's going to stop, you know. I've had enough of that. So, you know, are we ready for the path? Are we ready to journey, or are we still waiting for some kind of savior to take us by the hand and tell us, you're okay, my dear, everything will be fine. You'll be able to smell the flowers from the beginning of the path to the end. It'll be lovely, beautiful skies, lovely mountains. Everybody will love you. Your mind will be just blissful and peaceful and I promise you it will be like that. Well, if you want to really enter the realm of the present moment, you have to be fierce. Because, you know, what I mean by fierce, you have to be really awake. Because it's got very little, you know, it's sweet sometimes, but most of the time, delusion is not sweet. It's not a sweet piece of cake, I can tell you. In fact, delusion, you know, the Buddha compares it in the Dhammapada, there's some verses saying very clearly, when you walk the path, it's like going 1,000 times on the battle towards 1,000 men. I always like to translate it for women. It's probably more like having 1,000 times to face 1,000, you know, brats, kids. I have never had any children, but I can imagine having 1,000 kids, you know, for 1,000 lifetimes. That's probably about... I mean, each one of us can concoct our own kind of story of what the Buddha was pointing to. Remember, he was a male, so for him, you know, going into the battle against 1,000 men, 1,000 times. And Mara is not, you know, Mara, I mean, delusion. Mara is the personification of, you know, sort of what we call evil in Buddhism. Mara is, you know, is there all through the Buddhist, you know, history, you know, throughout all the teaching of the Buddha. Mara is present, you know. Mara is that which, in a way, takes us away from the present moment, takes us away from that place of clarity, insight, knowledge, from the place of peace, from the place of sanity. You know, Mara is nothing more than ourselves, as a famous Sufi teacher says so. If you want to know what the devil is, just look at yourself. You don't have to go very far. But most of ourself is quite sweet, isn't it? I mean, most of us are quite okay. We're not that bad, are we? So Mara has a lot of disguise, you know, comes into many guises. You know, as one of our teachers says, if you look, you know, if you want to know what Mara is about, just look at your comfort zone. So being awake, being present, you know, takes you to a place of great vulnerability. You know, you have to, you know, this vulnerability is part of the path, you know, being open, being totally, you know, have a real, it's like a realm of integrity, you know, where you really are totally open to hear what's happening now. To know what's happening now. And sometimes we can't always know, but if you meditate, if you practice, then your mind is always, you know, teaching you something. I remember when I was a younger nun, you know, whatever I did through the day, that wasn't kind of, you know, very nice. Because, you know, when you start training, it's, you're not very nice. I could feel like killing some people sometimes. Like punching them or, you know, wanting to smash them to pieces at times. And even still looking nice and sweet and loving and caring, you know, and people could imagine all kind of things about me. But sometimes you felt like you just wanted to strangle them. And it took me many years to actually realize I really dislike people intensely. And you live in community all the time, you know, with 50 people around you, you feel like being married to 50 people a lot of the time in community. We have intimate relationship, not on a sexual level, but in terms of mind intimacy, we're very intimate. You know, we know exactly what's going on in people's mind. We can see all their mistakes, their defaults, their, you know, their kind of weaknesses. Everything is out in the open, you know. I was married for 10 years. I don't think I had such an intimate relationship with my lovely husband, with whom I was very intimate. But yet, in community, when we live with people practicing together, you can start, you know what it's like. I mean, I'm sure in this Sangha, you know what it's like, how people can be so irritating, even when they are most loving and sweet. You just need to live with them for a little while, and you can start projecting onto them all the things that you find unsatisfactory in yourself. You know, or you don't even know about yourself. If you don't like your critical mind, for example, you can start noticing everybody's critical tendencies. And if you don't like your self-hatred, you can look at everybody and start looking how self-hatred they are. What kind of averse type they must be, these guys. Because you just hate yourself, but you don't quite know it yet. So, are we ready to walk this path, you know? To be awake and to be, you know. So a great chunk of our practice is actually building the right container. A container that can withstand what we are going to experience in this vulnerable awake state. And the container has to do with creating, you know, we're building up a home for ourselves, like a refuge, in which we can really, you could say, abide, you know, fairly comfortably. This is why the Buddha, you know, teaches as one of the first kind of, you know, first aspect of the path is sila, you know, ethic. As many of you probably know about the five precepts and so on. You know, not harming, not stealing, not taking anything that don't belong to you, not, you know, not having any sort of, not abusing anybody else or yourself with your own sexuality or your own sensuality. It's not even just sexual, but it's also anything to do with sensory desires, you know, using that energy for your own welfare and the welfare of others. Not, you know, speaking in ways that are harmful, and not taking drugs and intoxicants that confuse your consciousness. You know, so the precepts, at some level, you could, you know, are just, you know, sentences that we can repeat every week or once a year. On another level, they are just pointers to build up a more peaceful, abiding place in ourselves. Why? Because every time we move out of the, you know, out of, you know, we break any ethical standard, what happens is that there's a lot of regrets and a lot of unhappiness in ourselves. Because our heart, you could say the heart that is awakened already, knows better, you see. And so why it is difficult to enter this path is because we enter a path, it's like a war between your worldly mind and the heart of the spirit, you could say, or the heart of awakening, the Dharma heart. Not that we want to create a kind of duality between the two. It's not necessary to do that, but that's the experience, is that there's, you know, conflicting energy. And that's what I mean by going into the struggle, going into the battle. It's like, you know, you don't have to go into battle all the time, but it is meeting that kind of, you know, the desires that are not in line with what we truly, truly, deeply, deeply wish for ourselves. You know, if you are here in this room tonight, having practiced the Dharma for a number of years, it is obvious that you have already listened to the Dharma in yourself that is awakening, that is blossoming in your own being, that is, you know, really strengthening in yourself. So how much room do we give to that? And how much room do we give to our own ignorance and self-concerned desire, you know, selfish kind of constant obsessive self-concerns? And the pain that we experience is not so much that we don't want what is good for us, it's sometimes we just don't know how to do it. We just don't know how to get there. You know, we maybe want to be kind and loving and caring and patient, but all our habits are just in the way, aren't they? We find ourselves being averse, impatient, demanding, critical, and all the rest of it. So this is an interesting path, because it's not like a path where you surrender yourself to some kind of higher entities who is going to some, you know, past some magic or some kind of spiritual divine intervention. It's going to kind of transform your heart, and I'm sure taking the three refuges actually does that to some level. You know, whenever you take the three refuges and you really bow to those three refuges, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, you know, the awakened heart in yourself, the teaching of the Buddha, the truth, you know, the Dharma in your heart, and the and taking refuge in the, you could say, in the community of enlightened beings throughout the ages, you know, we do take refuge in something that is bigger than our own mind, you know, instead of taking in a refuge in me, mind, what I, you know, what upset me all the time, what is of self-obsessive in myself, I take refuge in my awakened heart, in the truth in myself, and in the, you know, in the support of all those, you know, all this kind of, what you call this, the Arya Sangha, or even just, you know, the support of my Dharma friends, you know, rather than me, mine. I'll open my heart to what is, you know, to a bigger space than just my little self-concerned mind. So, you know, when you look at yourself, you keep bumping into the obstacles. You know, that's why it can be frustrating sometimes. And if you don't have somebody who can explain to you that obstacles are actually quite okay, it's fine to feel wretched, undermined, weakened, all that sort of thing, because it's only states of mind, it's only perception, it's only, and it's changing. Of course, you know, the backdrop of all that is not always clear. That's why mindfulness is cultivated, because this is your backdrop. This is against this present moment experience, you will see all the things that is changing, you know. And sometimes those things are very deep and very rooted, and, you know, rooted in our own mind. You know, they are not easy to uproot, they're not easy to let go. Sometimes it takes years of observing some particular patterns or some particular responses to life. Everything in you knows better than that. And yet you have other, maybe emotional parts, or, you know, we know enough about psychotherapeutic, we have enough psychotherapeutic knowledge and understanding to go back to childhood experience or past life experience or whatever, you know, to realize that our mind is, you know, can be experienced as feeling quite stuck. Even a great chunk of ourselves isn't, feels fine. So, you know, to be able to turn around and keep taking refuge in the bit that is not stuck in us, it's a whole art, isn't it? It's a skill. That's what's called a spiritual path. It's to be able to keep looking at the part of ourselves which is already free, to keep taking refuge in that. You know. And of course, we need all the help we can get. You know, it doesn't happen on our own. There's nothing much we can do, really. We're lucky if we have a good teacher. I'm lucky to have a good teacher, like Ajahn Sumedho, I can go to him and ask him advice, or, you know, and he will. He's not going to pamper me, or he's not going to tell me how good I am. That's the last thing he's going to tell me, usually. You know, but to help, he can help me to hold something which is unbearable to hold, you know, which is really difficult to hold sometimes. And so going through that and letting go of all the things that you find unbearable to hold, you know, as you let go and actually intend to let go, you know, you make this intention very clear, which doesn't mean you have to do anything. It means whatever arises in the mind, you just don't cling to it. That's all. And you find, if you do this often enough with your own difficulty and your own problems, and you find that it actually works. Something shifts, something is transformed, something is, you know, your world changes. Your mind, consciousness is trained to go more and more towards the Dhamma, to have more and more confidence towards the realm of Dhamma, the realm of truth, the realm of liberation, you know. And to lose trust in the desires that, you know, in the fears, you know, because a lot of our inability to let go of things, that we're frightened. We're terrified of, you know, letting go of things. Because everything that we know is, you know, even when it is miserable, it's comforting on an emotional level. It's better than not knowing. I spent many, many years through the teaching of Ajahn Sumedho, especially in the first years, when he used to really help us to train the mind to learn to face the unknown, you know. Like to learn to train the mind to say, I don't know. Yes, but I don't know. Yes, I've got... No, I don't know. I don't know. Just training the mind, just like that, you know? And do that in your everyday life when somebody is going to tell you, yes, but I don't know. It's like you allow the Dharma to inform your consciousness. You may allow the Dharma to inform your consciousness rather than continue the kind of treadmill activity of the conditioned mind. Because the conditioned mind, that's all it can do. You know, it goes from one thought to another. And it's not that the thinking mind is, there's something wrong with it, but if you come to a, the thinking mind can be used to contemplate, which is another realm of mindfulness, awareness, awakefulness, and so on, when you really bring your thinking into a place of contemplation. You know, where you look at thoughts not just as a belief system, but just as they are energies, aren't they? Thought are energies, intentions. So you need to, you can clear, you know, what is it that you want to think and what you don't want to think. You know? A lot of the time when we don't do a deeper work on the level of our intention, you know, we can be very confused because we have so many mixed kind of view on things. You know, in the training, you come to those places where the only thing you can do is develop a lot of humor. Fortunately, I mean, that comes with the training, because it's so ridiculous what you have to go through that it makes you laugh a lot. You know, when you spend 4 hours in the forest at Chittas Monastery, you know, spreading metta to all beings, radiating, you know, concentrating your mind and radiating loving kindness, compassion to all beings, and come back to the nun's cottage and find one nun that just, you've been spreading, splashing her with metta, probably killing her with metta, you know, stifling her with metta. And then you come, she comes across your path as you go back home, and you see red and rage come up again within a split second. I mean, how can you not laugh, you know, after a while? Or you get very, very upset about people, the way they do salad dressings and things, you know, about the way, you know, you kind of, you know, your mind is kind of ennobled, you know, by lots of ennobling thoughts, like, you know, understanding insight, profound insight into the nature of reality, you know, realizing everything is changing, it's all appearances and it's all your mind. And then you cook in the kitchen, as a novice we could cook, you know, and find yourself completely going berserk about the way somebody chopped the carrots, you know, which is not the French way, for example. Not the French. Not the French will never do that. Who cares, you know? We only eat once a meal, one meal a day, so, I mean, who cares how we chop the carrots? But, you know, and you have all these ennobling kind of insights, and then you're in the kitchen. That's when you get to the real work, because the real work is, you know, what do you do with our emotional nature there? All the sort of, you know, the push buttons. I mean, the monastery life is like a huge, it's like a cauldron. You're all boiling together. You know, it's a pressure cooker. People come to the monastery and, you know, they don't have any idea, because at first it looks so peaceful. Everybody looked angelic, you know, pure-hearted, loving. Everybody looked, you know, nicely, neatly dressed, not too spotty or anything like that. They all sit in the same way, so, you know, can drive the more kind of eccentric type, just like a bit more chaos, you know. But anyway, for most people get quite inspired at first. And then when they start going into the monastic kind of routine in daily life and, you know, working together, they come to me or to somebody else and say, you know, I don't know, you know, I never had that in my life, you know. I mean, I see somebody just putting the lid in a certain way and I just want to, you know, smash them or smack them. Or I just see this person walking in front of me and, you know, I've been, you know, reading all this book on metta, and I've been trying to develop metta for the last several weeks, you know, and I feel so enraged by this person, you know, who's never even spoken to them. So, you know what, you can see what we are up against, you know, a lot of funny moments in our life, in a way, once you start looking at it. It is funny. But it is not funny when it goes really deep into your, you know, into the part that gets very wounded and very hurt, you know. We get very hurt. That's another thing. We're all very susceptible, you know. Our little ego gets very kind of agitated when it's not pampered and, you know, sweetened by a lot of nice words and so on. I always used to say how we, I mean, this is something I noticed in myself, you know, you can say to somebody, it's a whole group, like 1,000 people in front of you, you can say, well, you know, I'm an angry type. I'm very impatient, really. I'm not really nice with people, you know. I can be so nasty. You know, I just, you know, I've got lots of views and opinions about things, you know. I'm selfish and I can be quite jealous as well, you know. I haven't told many people, but I'm really quite jealous. And the person says to you, say, well, I actually agree with you. What? So as long as you tell yourself how, you know, stupid you are, then that's no problem. As long as the ego is kind of talking about itself, it can find all kind of, you know, ways of cheating itself, can't it? But ask somebody just dispassionately to tell you, you are so jealous, and you don't even know it. Look at the reaction, you know. Who? Me? Don't attack me. Don't tell me. What about you? That's what we do usually, you know. It's like, go on an offensive, you know. How about you? So you can see that the mind has a lot of ways of really deluding itself. And that's what we learn through the practice. The first stage, you know, is to, you know, talked about sila and the, you know, the bhavana or the samadhi which really in the Noble Eightfold Path, it's a path of mental development. You know, it's called, the path is called sila, ethics, samadhi, you know, practice, meditation, which is effort, energy, concentration and mindfulness, you know. And then you have the last one is panya, which actually on the path, in the description of the path, is the first two links, you know, the right intention and right understanding. So the bhavana, or the mental development, or the samadhi, which in this case doesn't mean concentration, it means the three aspects of the path related to mindfulness, effort, and concentration, the mind itself, the development of the mind. You know, in this development of the mind, we, you know, everything seems to be kind of easy to relate to as long as we talk about techniques, you know, how to do breathing, how to do mindfulness of the body, how to do all this. But not many people tell you what happens when you do this. You know, the actual, the hindrances that comes across, the obstacles, the confusion that we can experience, the frustration that can come, you know, in the body itself. You know, of course, a lot of moment of peace as well, you know. The practice leads to a lot of joy and a lot of happiness and peace. You know, but as long as it is dependent on something, of course, it's going to move and it's going to change. You know, so we can't count on something that's going to, that depends on changeable causes, you know, and permanent causes. So this is what this practice is leading you to understand a mind that is very treacherous in many ways, very tricky. And to be able to relate to ourselves in a sound, sane, kind way with this amount of trickiness, you know, and delusion there, is a real skill. You know, it's a training, it's an education, it's something we do little by little. We learn how to do this. It doesn't come by itself. You know, learning to, you know, first of all, learning to really take care of our action by body and speech. Most of us start with the mind, that you noticed, you know, we get interested in meditation and then notice through our meditation how much we get, how angry we can get, or how, you know, we just notice what we call the kilesa, you know, we do notice the or in some tradition it was called afflictive emotions or mental states that are very, you know, unpleasant. And then we notice our attachment, because even being attached to being a good person is painful. Because that very attachment is going to blind you and is going to project onto the world all kind of things. You know, that's what we do when we get, you know, fanatic about being a Buddhist or just start Buddhist practice. You know, we want to convert everybody. We go home and start telling our friends how, you know, we might have become a better person, have had maybe some retreat and done some retreat and gained some insights and be more at peace, you know, and then we attach to this and then we, you know, we become opinionated about our peacefulness and start projecting it onto other people. And if other people are not peaceful, they're just bad Buddhists. You know, they're just a nuisance. They're just not, obviously they must not be practicing. I am practicing, but they are not. Because I can be patient. Can you? You know, so there's a lot of, you know, a lot of elements in ourselves that are blinding. You know. And we unravel these things as we are ready to open ourselves to our life fully, fearlessly. And you can only do this if your goal is very clear. You know, if in yourself you're not able to reflect again and again that why, again and again, about what, why did you start on this path? What is it that, you know, what do you want to do with this path? Do you really want to be free? Really? Are you sure? Ask yourself, do you really want to be free? So you might be able to hear, well, no, I don't want to. You know, I just want my piece of cake and eat it. But if you can hear this voice, that's enough. You don't have to believe it. It's not you. No? Or you can hear yourself, your own reactions when I say this. Well, I don't know. Do I? Maybe not. Maybe I just want what I want. The hell with everything. But if you can listen to those voices, you're already, you know, the part of you, that awareness, that wakefulness in you, is part of your goal, isn't it? It's here now, and it's where you're going, you know, when the place where the mind is eventually released from all obstacles, all pain, all suffering, all dukkha, all miseries. And at some point, you have to be very clear that this path of practice, its sole purpose is to free the heart from its miseries. So when you go through miseries, don't, you know, don't shy away from it, because this is your opportunity. It's not a problem, it's your opportunity. It's what we're supposed to see. But you can see how much it takes training, because the mind is immediate. So as soon as you see something painful, it's like it recalls immediately. Or it's your fault. Kind of throw the ball in somebody else's court again. So to be able to read the mind in the correct way, it's a very powerful training. In the correct way. And it, you know, I just like to end with, I haven't spoken about the right understanding and the right, intention, but part of, you have already probably heard enough teaching on this, I'm sure, but part of right understanding and right intention is to be totally harmless towards ourselves. And that means fully accepting who we are, how we are. Part of right intention is non-harming and non-ill will. And the third aspect of right intention is renunciation, letting go. So you can see the wisdom aspect of your path. Two aspects of it is about being kind to oneself and to other people. And the third one is about releasing, letting go. And being kind, I had a teaching for my teacher this winter. He was talking about blessings. How do you bless, bless somebody? Which is kindness, isn't it? When you bless somebody, you're not going to curse them, are you? When I feel blessed, I feel that I'm very happy. And my teacher gave me a wonderful teaching on blessings. Of course, you can say, may you be happy, may you be great, may you be wonderful, may you have a long life, and so on and so on, whichever way you can bless somebody. But his definition of blessing was very interesting. Do not create anybody in your mind. Isn't it wonderful? Because most of us can do that. I mean, we can. We do it, but it's possible to do that. Which means instead of, wishing somebody to be happy, which is fine, but maybe you can't do that. So how are you going to bless them if you hate their guts, Maybe it's asking too much, and you can recognize that. But if you're going to bless your life in general, to bring a sense of happiness in your life, what my teacher said, just don't create people in your mind. That's already blessing them, because you free them from your own stuff. You don't imprison them with your own anger, with your own expectation, with your own frustration, with your own miserable mind. You don't ask them to be any way, any other way than the way they are. Isn't it wonderful? And it works. When he said that to me, I tell you, I was working on something very difficult. It works. Letting go. So I'll leave you on this. Do you have any questions, please? Yes. A different what?
Person, like myself. My name is Sherry.
Oh, Sherry.
So I interact with you, and I'm Sherry in a certain way.
Yeah.
And I interact with somebody else, and I'm Sherry, but in a different way.
Yes, yes, yes.
And that's kind of disconcerting.
Yes. It should not be. We have about a million characters in ourselves. Don't worry about that.
you know, in one day you can have 20 different characters coming up, you know.
So which one is real?
None. Rodney, I just assume this is okay to help myself. Huh? None are real. That's a thing. You know, you're none of them. On a conventional level, we have to be somebody, you know. Okay? So, you learn to dance with these different characters. I mean, 26 years ago, I would have thought, what an hypocrisy. You know, I'm like this with that person, and I'm like this with this person, and I'm like that with this person. How hypocritical that can be. No, it's not. It's just, you know, you just learn about humanity, you know. With some people you speak in that way, with another person you speak differently. You just become wise about human nature. The way you talk to your mother is going to be different. The way you talk to your lover, isn't it? The way you talk to your son or child is going to be different from the way you talk to your best friend. Isn't it? So. And if somebody pushes your buttons, you get a tyrant out of yourself. And if somebody pampers you and says how wonderful you got, you know, you'll get a sweet sherry. And if I push your buttons, you'll get, you know, the angry sherry, probably, if I did a good job with you. If I was skilled enough. Do you know? And so we have all these different characters, you know. You just have to know that they exist. But they're not really characters. They're just sensations in the body that turn into a self. That's what it's called. It turns into a self. We've got endless selves in ourselves. You know? So, what is your question?
So, then it seems like, really, when there's an interaction between two people, it's not two selves, it's the interaction. It's like the interaction is what is in the now. Not the two people, in a sense. I mean, I know they're there, but it's the interaction that is creating the present, not the people.
Well, it's many conditions that are creating the present, you know. I mean, even the way you have eaten your lunch could create the conditions that are taking place in an interaction, you know. Or the way what you're going to do in the evening could have a different, put you in a different mood, you know. So there are many, many things, many factors, many elements that can influence you in your any interaction with anybody or any situations. I still don't know your questions, but never mind.
You're answering.
Okay. Good.
I would just like to say how much I appreciate your honesty about your mind and the way it is. It just makes me... It's so much easier to be with myself after
that. I'm very glad.
Being in practice and noticing all the characters and all the faces that come up, that my mind wants to take the teachings of the Buddha and interpret them, that I'm supposed to be wiping out those characters.
You're beyond these characters? No, sorry.
Trying to like wipe out the characters.
Oh, yes,
which I know
yes,
it's
yes.
Not necessary, it's not the practice, but yeah. That's where my mind wants to take it, that my practice is supposed to be about wiping those things out, so that I'm this like faceless being.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a very, very strong tendency in ourselves to want to get rid of things. It has a name. You can actually recognize it. It's one of the causes of suffering. It's the second truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, samudaya, dukkha samudaya. and that is wanting to get rid of, you know, the thing you don't like. So, if you create a perception in your mind about the very various cells that you don't like, that force in you is strong in all of us. You know, we all suffer. We all have this disease of wanting to get rid of the thing we don't like and wanting the thing we like. One is called bhava tanha, attachment to becoming, and vibhava tanha, attachment to non-becoming. So you don't want to become those nasty characters, but you want to become the emptiness of a peaceful mind. You see? So you need to recognize when that is happening. It's not the characters, the perception and the idea and the thought, it's not so important. You need to recognize the feeling in your heart of that desire. It's kind of aversion. It's another aspect of aversion. You know, it's an averse mind state. That's the basis for this way of thinking. So that's how you can perhaps start undoing, you know, this tendency. Just noticing when you want to do that, it's called, you say, name it, even aversion. Nothing wrong with this. We all have that. When you want to become successful and wonderful and peaceful and all that, this is bhava tanha, attachment to becoming something that you like. And when these characters, you know, it's kind of painful, isn't it, to notice a tendency to not accept parts of yourself which you need to go, you know, to understand better rather than wipe out, you know. But it's very normal. It's quite a normal tendency. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just you could say it's your field of investigation for this, you know, to know better this vipava tanha, you know, this desire to get rid of things you don't like. Very strong, very powerful, especially in the Western mind. You know, we're quite angry types, averse type. You know, we know how to get rid of things. We've been taught how to do that. You know, don't like that, just let, you know. In fact, our conditioning is such that when we don't know how to get rid of things that we don't like, we are seen as stupid often, don't we? Aren't we? I mean, it's stupid to be patient with a thing we don't like. And yet that's what the Buddhist teaching is asking you, to be very patient with a thing you don't like. So you can see what we are against. You know, what we are faced with. Yeah?
This question seems a little bit off. I'm very interested in the part of your talk in which you compare cultures. And you talked about the tendency of Western culture to be encouraging critical thinking. It's always, I've always thought that tendency in our culture is something that along the Buddhist path, we ought to try and overcome, that it's inherently an impediment, and you present it very differently. And I wonder, you know, when you compare to Western culture, to Asian culture, it's a generalization, but you said there's a tendency to be more faithful. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought, well, if we were more like that, we would be more successful on this path. But that's not how you're presenting it. I wonder if you could
You know, the Buddhist path is not about being anything. It's about understanding what is preventing you from being free. So it's not about taking a position for or against anything. As you say, it's a broad generalization about Asian being more faithful, you know, Westerners being more critical mind, and, you know, have more of a critical thought, you know, conditioning. And so, you know, that's just how we are. We're not, you know, you're not going to liberate somebody that you're not. You know, you're not liberating an ideal, are you? Which we like that, you know, we like the idea of liberating an idea, an ideal. So you're liberating somebody who has been brought up into a culture which is, you know, has developed a lot of critical thinking. You'll be happy to hear that within the Buddhist kind of definition of different characters, you know, the Buddha has defined human beings as having certain tendencies. You've got the greedy type, You've got the averse angry types, you've got the doubtful type, the discursive type, the, you know, faith type, and so on. The angry type, you know, the sort of, you know, the averse type, you know, we talk about critical mind, it can be called an averse mind too, is very close to the wisdom mind. You know, just in the same way that the critical, averse type, mind, angry type wants to get rid of things, in the wisdom practice, the wisdom is also giving, sending you the understanding to let go of things, which is another way, you don't get rid of them, just let them go. Or, you know, the wisdom type knows immediately what's, you know, the obstacle that you have. It knows immediately, and maybe you get a lot of energy to really practice with that. You see what I mean? You understand quickly, and that gives you a lot of confidence to get, you know, get going with your practice, because you know how it's going to work, kind of thing. So you can lose, even this averse tendency can be used for your own benefit, you know, once you bring wisdom into it, you know. So this averse tendency will lead you to feel maybe more energy to let go of things, because you've seen clearly how painful something can be. So we get averse to the things that we don't like, that are painful usually. Very rarely get averse to you know, an ice cream or a nice cake. You know, it's very rare, isn't it? Mostly averse to some kind of... somebody said, tomorrow we're going to fast for 3 days. What a horror. Yeah. So, yeah, there is no kind of, you know, our confidence as Western kind of conditioned mind grow in a different way. You know, it doesn't mean we have less faith or less confidence. It's just, it goes through a different channel. We need to understand. But often, as often the teacher will say to those idealistic Westerners that we can be, you know, it's like we know exactly where we are going, but we have no patience to set the causes to do that. A lot of the time we are totally obsessed by the goal. We have no interest in setting up the causes to get there, because we don't have a lot of confidence in that. You know, we don't have confidence much in doing the nitty-gritty to get the results, you know. Like, for example, just being a bit kinder every day, or a bit more patient every day, or a bit less tyrannical, or cultivate a better speech every day. A little bit, you know. Little bit by little bit, and see the result, you know, over a period of time. We don't have a lot of confidence. And so the critical faculty is actually very important in the Buddhist teaching. I mean, the Buddhist teaching it's not a, what you call a devotional path, it's a wisdom path, and it requires the capacity to think clearly, you know, to understand clearly through clear thinking as well. You know, so that aspect of the mind is very important, you know, because the thinking can be an obstacle, but it's also a tool. I mean, thinking is allows you to come to some deeper understanding. And then, after that, you integrate that into your everyday life, and that's sometimes what we are lacking. We don't know how to really root our understanding into our everyday experience. So it, in a way, so that it can reverberate, you could say, or nourish all the parts in ourselves, the emotional parts, the aspect of, you know, the precepts or the ethical parts, you know, that the part of ourselves, you know, the physical body, you know, just to train the body in the right way, you know, our action and so on, and even the well-being of our own body. When we feel more at peace, when we have less regret, when we are more clever and wise to our own mind and body, then we feel happier, you know. But you have to recognize that Mara is always around the corner, you know, and always trying to destroy something. a very powerful force, you know. That destructive force is very powerful. It's not a small thing. So don't take it as a personal problem. Even the Buddha was tempted by Mara for 45 years after his enlightenment. Can you imagine? So many stories of those enlightened monks and nuns, you know, Mara will just before the enlightenment, Mara will come and say, sisters, why are you sitting here gaunt and lonely? Well, you could be making merit, you know, and having a nice boyfriend or something. And the nuns, you know, will say, I know you, Mara. I've seen through all this. I mean, I'm paraphrasing it, you know. I know you, Mara. You're not going to fool me. So does that answer your question?
Very much.
Appreciate your thinking mind, you know, but use it. Make it work for you rather than being a slave of your thinking mind. Yeah? Yeah? Yes.
And I think, oh, okay, well, big deal. The worry just disappears. Now that I'm investigating, and I can go into it, that's pretty breathing. Well, that's just a trick. Sounds like I just took a rattle from a baby. And I sometimes question the very process of the investigation.
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah. Yeah, sometimes it can feel that we are fooled by our own ability to be mindful. You know, it almost disappeared. It disappears too quickly, or that's what you're saying. That you, but it's just the nature of the mind. You know, the mind just creates things, and as soon as you're mindful, you stop creating, and that is gone. You haven't fooled yourself, but Mara will tell you you fooled yourself because it's lost its job. It's kind of running out of fun, you know. The more you think and the more you worry, the more Mara is happy. She's earning a living, you know, with your delusion. Remember that. So that's all there is to it. You know, you just stop creating. And I know it takes a while to feel more confident in that, you know. We haven't got a lot of, you know, for a long, long time, we feel that if we think and worry and think and think and think and worry, we're doing something good, you know. And then if you stop worrying, suddenly you don't know how to look at the world anymore. You say, what do I do next, kind of thing. How am I going to deal with the world without my worry? It's going to be a really strange feeling, isn't it? But you have, it's like homeopathic remedy, you know. It's a little by little. It's like you get a little, you know, a little, the body gets used to a little dosage of the homeopathic remedies to cure the poison, you know. Yeah? And so little by little you get a little dosage of mindfulness and the ending of your worry, for example. The ending seems so alien to us that Mara comes along and says, oh, I can fool him, you know. You know, I don't think he's just been doing all this to you, really. It's not really the right work. You've just been fooling yourself. That's just Mara. Do you understand? You have to really trust. So maybe you need your teacher to kind of strengthen that trust in the cessation of. That's exactly what the Third Noble Truth is about, cessation, you know. When Nirodha, sometime equated to Nibbana, you know, the kind of momentary nibbanic, you know, experience is that cessation, and there's nothing there. So that's all there is to it. You know, it's like, you know, emotionally, it's kind of baffling because there's nothing happening. If somebody said you're going to be happy forever, you'll be sitting in heaven, you know, with bell ringing and so on. Emotionally, the heart is like that, you know, but it's no bit nibbana. You know, cessation is emotion, is totally, there's nothing there, it's just peace. We're not used to peace. Learn how to be at peace. Find what peace is about, because most people don't want peace. Find it so boring. Well, momentary, between, you know, 10,000 years of excitement, you might like a moment of peace. But most of us really are not so interesting in peace, because peace is on the ego level, self level, is nothing for it, you know. It's a death of the ego, it's peace. But until we experience the fullness of this peace and the power of this peace, you know, and the it's real, like the power of understanding or the power of, you know, of the mind that is not bound by this kind of you know, limitation of self knowledge, you know, the knowledge, the conditioned mind, you're really lost, you know, you feel like a little orphan suddenly in that big vast space, you know, I've lost my worry, and you cling to any old worry just to kind of find a familiar ground again. Does that make sense? So I know exactly what you're saying, because my mind has been through this many times, you know. I say, God, you know, I'm sure it's, you know, I'm sure I'm not doing it right, you know, because as soon as I'm mindful, you know, it all disappears. So, any more questions? So it's just,
it's
say
like,
that again.
It's like you're just there.
Yeah.
Else.
Yeah, yeah.
And then slowly, for me, it's like the fades, and now I'm back. Like you come back from a journey.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'm left with this feeling of like a moth that wants to get back to the flame. And it's very distracting because.
Martha wants to go back.
Moth, you know, moth is always drawn to a flame.
Oh, the moth.
So it's, like,
yeah.
It's like that bliss. It's like
yeah,
the
yeah.
flame.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when you sort of come back out of that,
yeah.
You just want to go back. And that's very distracting. For me, it makes everything else seem insane and crazy because my mind just wants to go back to that peace.
Yeah.
It just wants to go back home.
Yes. Yeah.
What would you do with that?
You just notice a dukkha. You know, I understand. I mean, I hear what you're saying. Yes. In, from the Buddhist perspective, we will call it craving for peace. So it's another craving, another desire. You know, momentary peace is great, you know. But if it's still depending on the way things are, you know, that when certain things happen, you're not at peace. When other things happen, you'll find peace. When certain circumstances take place, you find some peace. When other circumstances take place, it's still a conditioned peace, you know, which is still conditioned by craving. You know, so I'm sorry to bring such a bad news to you, but...
Well, it just seems to me that for me, it's always just happened like as if I was walking down the street and I stubbed my toe. It just happened.
Yeah.
And I suddenly just...
Oneness, yeah.
And then,
yeah.
Like over time, like if you get drunk, you slowly aren't drunk anymore. And then for an alcoholic, they just want to get drunk again.
Yeah.
But for me, it's like once I've experienced that peace and bliss, it's very distracting because I just want to get back to it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
it's wanting, wanting.
It's like having the experience created the craving.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So
now.
So try to drop the craving?
Drop the craving, yeah. Peace comes and peace goes, you know? And then your human life is not about craving peace, your human life. Your human life is about being with life as it is. Because otherwise you become much more too choosy and picky about what you want and don't want. You know, because, you know, as soon as you want it, it becomes, you're chasing a memory, a phantom, you know, a shadow. It's not reality. You're not in reality anymore. you know, you want an unreal thing. So it's very important not, you know, to see what you're doing. Yeah?
I don't have a question, I have a comment.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I'm finding your approach, your talk, your presence phenomenally refreshing and informative. There's such a practical nature to the teachings tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And such a wisdom that I really thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions? I haven't heard any question of Patisha Samupada yet.
Thank you so much.